Well, hello and welcome to New Business Paradigms. I'm Christy Jansen, Chief of Staff here at the World Business Academy, and I am with Ronaldo Brutico, the Academy's president and founder. And of course, Benjamin Schwartz, our radio production intern, is also with us today. The World Business Academy is a nonprofit dedicated to elevating the consciousness of people in the business community and encouraging business leaders to use their power and influence to take greater responsibility for the communities and the environment their work touches. We are recording this show on November 9th, 2018. And before we get going, I want to invite our listeners to reach out to us at info@worldbusiness.org if you have questions or comments about the show today, or if you have anything you'd like us to discuss in the future. We would love to hear from you. As always, you can listen to us on the go using Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Blog Talk Radio. Just search the World Business Academy. Great. So, Ronaldo, I think we had promised to have this show today, November 9th, to take a look at what happened with the midterm elections. And so here we are. Want to get going on that?
So here we are. And let me share with everybody who will be happy, I'm sure, to hear this. We're not going to do a whole show on politics. There's plenty of that on the airwaves. You're going to get more. It's going to be a surplusage of commentary on politics. I do want to make a couple of quick comments as a way to set the stage for what's going to follow, because what we want to talk about is the economy and what we can learn for ourselves to be better prepared for the economy that's here and what's coming based on the election and other factors. And we scheduled the show because I felt I wouldn't be able to do that with any confidence, not knowing the outcome of the election. In fact, some of you may recall, I said that if, in fact, there was not a blue wave, meaning if the Democrats didn't take the House, that I didn't think the American public could survive as we know it. And I'm glad to see that that turned out to be something that we got passed. And I just want to start by commenting. I genuinely speaking, like Nicholas Kristof as an author. He's a columnist. He writes for the opinion section of the New York Times. And most of what he writes, I tend to resonate with. I think he's a thoughtful guy and he does his homework. I think he really missed it by a country mile yesterday. He did the editorial in the New York Times, in which he incorrectly identified what happened as not a blue wave, but a blue ripple. And he goes on to explain why it wasn't such a great day after all. And I without going into it and criticizing him line by line, I just want to start with that perception. That's so fundamentally wrong. What happened was enormous. And let's talk about why it was enormous just for a second. It was enormous because we went from literally no checks and balances, a government that not only was out of control and hurting our own country, but was increasingly being looked at around the world as a major destabilizing force. 2-3 days ago, Trump's ambassador to NATO threatened to send a missile to hit Russia because it was making intermediate range missiles in violation of a treaty. She took it back within about 3-4 hours, but of course it was an insane thing to say. And that braggadocio, that jingoistic, that chip on the shoulder Trump thing had so badly infected our politics, and lying had become so common. Just to put a number to that, as of the election, Washington Post had documented 6,400 lies since Trump took office. Not like by exaggeration.
Just by Trump or
just by Trump. Just by Trump.
That doesn't count the rest of his administration.
Think of how many that is a day.
Right.
Now, it's about time the media started calling lies, lies. Quit pussyfooting around. The fact of it is, the guy lies constantly, and he does for only one reason. He lies for personal advantage. And he lies because it doesn't bother him to lie. To him, the lie is the same as the truth if it serves his objectives. Well, that kind of government with no checks and balances in a country as powerful as the United States is a prescription for unmitigated disaster on a global level. So we're going to talk in a few minutes about how our current economic situation is not optimum, even given what you might think based on the first day after the election's results in the Dow, which, by the way, now the Dow is back down again, coming down. It will continue to come down. Without talking about the stock market, because the stock market is different from the economy. They're not synonymous. And it's on a good day, the stock market can hopefully tell you what might be coming in the economy 6 months out. On a good day, and that's if it does everything right. Even then, it doesn't get it right that often. It isn't synonymous, however, with the economy. Mm-hmm. And so what Kristof isn't recognizing, because he's not an economist, he's not a business guy, he doesn't realize what an enormous difference there is now. I'll give you an example. He writes for the New York Times. In this election, according to the documentation I've seen, 2/3 of Wall Street money went to the Democrats for the first time in decades. Why? Because Wall Street got what it wanted from Trump. It got the tax, a huge tax reduction, and particularly the individual one is really, really happy news for the people in the private equity community. And they got the repatriation of foreign earnings. And that's all they're going to get. And Wall Street got concerned when the tariff thing started that Trump, although he had given them a personal benefit worth many, many billions, he was going to tank the economy with a silly tariff program because he doesn't understand what tariffs are or how they work. And as a result, Wall Street started to panic. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh my goodness, we got to get some sense here. We got to get some checks and balances.
So
that is not a ripple. And also Christoph's wrong numerically because as of this morning, it appears that the Democrats have taken at least 32, looks like it may be 35 seats.
I think it may even go as high as 37, 30,
it could,
38.
But when you're in the 30-plus range, which is where we clearly are now, that's very substantial. That's a major shift. Number two, the fact that there will now be oversight, the subpoena power of the Congress, to look into all of these different scandals and all these different abuses.
It's a game changer for how the government will operate.
Yeah. It really is. And it's a game changer, too, from the point of view of the, I believe, over 6.5 million more people voted for a Democrat in this election than voted for a Republican, which is enormous when you consider that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by only 3 million votes. So they doubled the popular vote effect. Mm-hmm. Then when you take into account, they also picked up 7 governorships, flipped one for a total of 8. So one went from blue to red, but the other 7 went red to blue. And in places like Kansas, like Wisconsin, Michigan,
Nevada.
Absolutely. And on two things, Nevada on the governor and Nevada on the Senate seat.
And the jury's not in for Georgia or Florida yet.
No, and Sinema looks like she's going to win, which wasn't the case when Nicholas wrote this.
That's right.
And I think that in Florida, as we were saying before we went on air, you know, with that new law that passed in Florida that mm-hmm. the felons are going to get their vote back, that's 1.5 million Floridians now get to vote who never got to vote before. And the last time I checked, there were primarily people of color, which means they primarily historically voted Democratic. Mm-hmm. And I think they're aware it's the Republicans who kept them from voting. So they're not going to be really friendly about that. So 1.5 million new voters hit the waves. Well, that's more than any conceivable differential you're going to see again in the state of Florida between Republicans and Democrats. So that's a big thing. Another huge thing that happened, people have to understand that Nicholas mixed. The most powerful man in Washington is and has been for some time, not the president. It's the guy who sits there, who has the unilateral ability to fire the president if he wishes. Mitch McConnell, and I believe he will fire the president, by the way, and he'll fire him before 2020. McConnell's got the ability and the right to fire the president, but the president cannot fire McConnell. That's an enormously different position. So what's McConnell looking at? McConnell's looking at how big a drubbing did they take, and what's going to happen to all the senators in states that went blue who are currently Republicans 2 years from now.
Right. To talk about the Senate results, it was so slanted towards the Republicans' favor in this particular election cycle.
Yes, because there was more.
So many of the seats. Democrats who were retiring or running here were in very, very red states. So to give them credit, I think it was the best map for the Republicans since like 1912 or something like that.
It's
it
huge.
Was 100 years.
And remember, and the Senate, by definition, is not Democratic. In other
right.
words, there are 2 senators from the state of Montana where the cows outnumber the people.
Yeah, I think they only have one representative in the House
state.
Because
every district, House district, as long as you get one, mm-hmm. is 750,000 people. People don't know that, but that's... So when you get to a place like California, every 750,000, you got to draw a line.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing that just happened, which is that because the state houses have changed, and because of the amount of pushback to all of the vote suppression that occurred, in places like Georgia,
not
in
to
places
mention the like gerrymandering.
Kansas, the gerrymandering. All of that now gets turned around. In fact, in a couple of states, they actually passed new statutes to deal with drawing district lines, as we have in California. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you know, in California, as an example, both the Democrats and the Republicans fought an impartial group of citizens to set up the district lines. I don't know if you knew that or not. And the only way we got it through was on a ballot initiative. In other words, we forced it down the two parties. What you're seeing is I believe, the breakup of the two-party system. I couldn't be happier about that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think that Christoph missed is, and I started talking about Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell said 8 days before the election, Okay, so this is over, then we're going to go after Social Security and Medicaid because we can't pay for the deficit otherwise. Meaning the only way to pay for those tax breaks we handed out to the top 2%, we got to go now take that money from middle class and poor people by reducing Medicaid, reducing Social Security, et cetera. No way he can do that now, of course. But I would have argued he could have done that even if he won the House, because there's nothing like an old white Floridian who thinks that their Social Security has been threatened. But what really happened here is a wave of people who normally don't vote came up. Mm-hmm. Young people voted this time. Hispanics voted in record numbers this time. The black vote hasn't been this high since Obama ran. And my favorite one is college-educated white women who got bamboozled last time, and they came out in strong force this time. So this coalition of people who got activated because they said, you know what, this doesn't look like our country. This is not who we are as a nation. So Trump did his job, and he did it brilliantly. He got his base out. But as I have said on this show many times, his base isn't that large. It's at most 35% of the population. That leaves two-thirds of us on the other side of the equation. And two-thirds of us basically are saying no in a big, big way. Even in Republican districts that went Republican this election, on average, the Republican lost 10% from where they were in the prior election.
Right. It's much lower. Lower
people
showing.
Who never thought they'd ever have to worry about getting reelected, like Devin Nunes, had to fight for his seat. People like Dana Rohrabacher, who's been there forever, lost his seat.
Well, look how close Beto came to unseating Cruz.
Yeah, in Texas.
The idea that a Democrat came within 2.5 percentage points.
And Texas has a lot of voter suppression itself and tremendous gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. So with all the voter suppression that went on before this election, which to this minute is still playing itself out and will continue now, my view, to take the difference that Christoph is saying, my view is there really was a wave. It was a blue wave. Mm-hmm. But the wave didn't change the course of the country overnight. What it did is it stopped the downward slide. Mm-hmm. We've bottomed out. For those people who have ever been in Alcoholics Anonymous or know anyone who has, there's a great saying in the program, called The Program, is you don't hit bottom till you stop digging. And what we did in this election, the wave is we stopped digging. So are we out of the hole? No, we dug a heck of a hole this time. Mm-hmm. We let ourselves get into one big pickle. But now we can begin to dig our way out. Now, why is that so important in the context of today's conversation? Because the implications politically of what happened are extremely significant economically. So here's what I now feel pretty comfortable we can predict. And we'll touch on some things that are yardsticks in the future in a moment, like we've talked about in the past. Like we'll talk about what happened to the inverted yield curve, and we'll talk about gold and oil and all that stuff, and we'll talk about real estate. But the key issue here is this country was heading so fast into what's called a plutocracy. Now, a plutocracy basically is an economy designed for the wealthy. Mm-hmm. That's what a plutocracy is. The trouble with plutocracies, the biggest problem, because we've had them many times in the past, virtually the entire Middle Ages was plutocracy. So it's a very small handful of people at the top who get most of the goodies. That's a plutocracy.
Yeah, well, we talked about that last time, the plantation economy.
That's right, the plantation mentality. Okay. Mm-hmm. What happened here, which is very interesting, is plutocracy easily tips into fascism. Mm-hmm. Because fascism, as you recall, is state socialism, meaning it's the justification that it's okay if to take care of people's money, you got to kill other people. It's interesting that the pipe bomb sender, 15 bombs that went out, was well known for being a big, big fan of Adolf Hitler. Spoke about it frequently at work. His boss quoted him on how he thought that Adolf Hitler was the greatest guy in the world, and we ought to have more guys like Hitler because he had the right idea and he was going to protect the white people, blah, blah, blah. Clearly a white nationalist, clearly an anti-Semite. You can't like Adolf Hitler if you are pro-Israeli. But what's amazing to me is the same thing was true of the guy who went in that same week and shot 11 people dead in the synagogue. And his thing was, I got to kill all the Jews because the Jews are behind the globalist conspiracy. Now, whenever you hear the words globalist conspiracy, it's a dog whistle for Jew.
Right.
And we're going to talk about one famous dog whistle on that subject in a moment. But, to me, now that we stop digging, so we're at the bottom of this hole, and I look around and go, how bad is it for us in this hole? Looks pretty good. Unemployment looks good. People have been buying stuff. I mean, people are looking around going, in fact, I believe the last statistic taken 2 days before the election, something like 65% of the American population or 60% thought the economy was doing just great, which it's not.
The economy is like Swiss cheese. If it weren't for the holes, you wouldn't be able to recognize it because there's a lot of holes in this economy. So what Christoph missed, and this is my final commentary on the political side, is that the politics of the moment have shifted such that the people who came out for the first time and who decided to reclaim their country, now they are in a position to do something about that, to reclaim their economy, because as they get used to the idea their economy is not so good, because it ain't so good for them, because they're not the plutocrats. Mm-hmm. They're everybody else. So by definition, when you take care of the top 2%, how many are left that you didn't take care of? 98%. A whole bunch of that 98% figured it out and went to the polls. Mm-hmm. A whole bunch more will. And give an example, and I was saying it earlier to you, Christy. Can you imagine you're a soybean farmer in Iowa? 96% of all the soybeans you used to sell to China, you didn't sell this mm-hmm. year. 96%. There's so many piles of soybeans, you can't find a grain elevator to store them in. So they're leaving them in giant mountains in the field, covered with tarps, in the hope that they'll sell them before they rot, and they won't. They will rot.
They will rot.
In those same jurisdictions, they reelected people like King in Iowa. So not everybody figured it out yet. Even the mm-hmm. people in the bottom of the plutocratic triangle, the people who are sitting at the bottom of the pyramid getting crushed. And by the way, China's the biggest source of foreign earnings for our agricultural exports because of its soybean purchases.
Right.
So the people there haven't figured out yet. And they're still mouthing this thing, well, you know, the strong man, Trump, he's got a secret plan that will protect us. Just like his secret plan to denuclearize North Korea, which turns out to be a complete joke and always was. So what does it say about the economy? It says that today, now we can look around at each other and go, okay, how are we going to get ourselves out of this mess?
Mm-hmm.
And let's just talk about that for a second.
So, I mean, I just, before you move on, I just sort of want to restate what you're saying here is that we really did have a reorientation in the political realm.
Mm-hmm.
This was a reset. A
reset.
It was a citizen uprising. It was a blue wave. But we have a really far way to go. We've got a lot of dirt to fill back up this hole.
Yeah.
And what this allows is for us to start a reorientation of the economy.
Yeah. And what I'm saying is it wouldn't have been possible without the political change.
Right.
And that's why I couldn't predict going into this election, because if the House didn't get taken over,
mm-hmm.
I would be very concerned about a catastrophic mm-hmm. dissent.
And to the extent that the people like in Iowa or these folks who really have been hurt by some of Trump's trade policies didn't vote for a Democrat or they still
right.
they stayed in the Trumpian cult.
Mm-hmm.
I really do think that the fear-based rhetoric that was evident in the shooter, both at the Kroger's and the Pittsburgh synagogue.
The Kroger's being where that guy went looking for black people.
Right,
to shoot.
Yeah. Exactly. But anyway, we still have a far way to go.
On that point, you know, I've had several really good conversations in the last 4 or 5 days with really close Jewish friends who wanted to give Trump a pass because they thought he was good on Israel. Now, frankly, I think Netanyahu is very bad for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Trump has not done Israel any favors. And assigning Jared to be the Israeli go-between, I mean, Netanyahu might think that's funny, but it hasn't done Israel any good and won't. The real issue, though, is that my Jewish friends, for the most part now, realize if you are a white nationalist, if you are a white supremacist.
Or even a nationalist.
Or even a nationalist, which Trump knows what that means, which is a white nationalist.
I know.
You don't only hate brown and black and yellow people. You always have to add Jews in there.
Well, that's rhetoric.
That's what it is.
That's the whole narrative.
That's the narrative.
It's these globalists. It's the George Soros of the world that are funding the caravans that are coming up from Central America.
Apart from how crazy that is on its face,
it is crazy.
What I'm calling out here, and I hope there's a lot of Jewish friends of mine listening to this program. I've been trying to say for a long time: don't give the guy a pass. He is a white supremacist. And just because his daughter converted to Judaism doesn't mean he's safe.
Mm-mm.
Hitler was half Jewish. Don't get caught up in this. The problem is, like Hitler, who came to power and didn't know what power was until he got there, and was primarily supported by the industrial class. Okay, the arms of Krupp were behind Hitler. Mercedes-Benz was behind mm-hmm. Daimler. Obviously, Volkswagen was created by Hitler. So he didn't know what he had till he got in power, and the financial interests thought of him as their puppet until it turned out he was not a puppet. It turned out he was his own crazy guy, and look what he did. We got the same problem. Trump is not a puppet. Trump has made a fool. He's right. taken over the Republican Party. There is no more Republican Party. It's the party of Trump. He's single-handedly done more damage to the economy than any president in recent history. This whole thing with tariffs is insane. And let me get a quote this Peter Navarro article. Now, Peter Navarro, who people may not know, but Peter Navarro is the one of the principal economic advisors to Trump. And he has such a weak academic pedigree, no one ever took him seriously, ever. And he ends up in the White House. And his big idea is, let's do tariffs. Now, I'm certain beyond a shadow of a doubt, Trump does not know what tariffs are or how they work. No question, he doesn't. I don't think Navarro does. I mean, Navarro is such a lightweight. And the funny thing about this, people like me used to talk about Peter Navarro as a lightweight before he got the job. And then he went and proved it. So to the extent I could have been wrong with that assessment, he's concluded. So here's Navarro. Okay.
Talking about the Politico article from today?
Yeah, from today, yeah. So he's, and the headline, I love it. Navarro tells Wall Street globalist billionaires, that's a Jewish reference, right? Jewish dog whistle, to end shuttle diplomacy in U.S.-China trade war. Now, he loves the idea of a trade war, as does, what's his name, Bannon loves a trade war, because Bannon's a white nationalist, too. And at the end of the day, everybody in China is yellow. So right off the bat, it ain't going to work for a white nationalist. Now, the reason I'm making this comment is, not only is that a dog whistle on globalist, because anytime you use the word globalist or globalist believers, that's a reference to Jewish international bankers. That's what that is. And everybody in the white supremacy community knows that. What I really want to point out, though, is the story is about the fact that Navarro is saying, please, Wall Street and private equity partners, stop going to China telling them that we will back down because you're really hurting our ability to cause China to buckle, which isn't going to happen anyway. And so what Wall Street's doing is Wall Street saying, we got to cover ourselves here because the administration is not capable of representing American business interests. And why I like this article so much is it really underscores the entire purpose of the World Business Academy. Our job is to help business realize it is responsible for the whole of society. And business is doing its job when it's saying to the Chinese, this guy's a little crazy, don't worry, we don't want a trade war, we don't want a shooting war. Hutchison Bailey to the contrary, we don't want to shoot missiles at the Russians, and we don't want to have a trade war with the Chinese. And we didn't have a war with Mexico and Toronto, with Canada. I mean, the NAFTA deal that he made a big brouhaha about canceling basically is the same deal we just got. A little bit worse for the United States, not much, but it's the same deal. And so he created a phony issue, which he does all the time, and he, quote, solved it by signing a deal that's just like the deal he just tried to cancel.
Yeah.
Well, Navarro, by pointing out, and I'm glad he is, that Wall Street has now begun to develop its own diplomacy because they recognize the U.S. government's incapable of representing American business interests. I want to go further. And I want to say they're not capable of representing America's fundamental humanist values either. So if you look at Wall Street today, and you know I spend a ton of time there, particularly with Just Capital, the majority of the Fortune 500 companies all have a much better view of, much better view of the environment, have a much stricter view on the whole necessity for clean water, clean air, have a much better view on a balanced economy, have a much better view on the idea of a free trade amongst nations. I mean, I could go down the line. Wall Street actually right now is far more benign in its outlook and positive than is the American government. So Navarro's doing us a favor by calling it out because although it's a dog whistle to be anti-Semitic, what he's really saying is, gee, quit playing cards behind us because, you know, you're undercutting the president. Yeah, and you need to undercut this guy because this guy's kind of a nut job. So the Chinese war, just to start with that, the trade war, so-called, which as I already referenced, is already basically decimating the soybean growers. Mm-hmm. It's hurting cattle producers. It's hurting chicken producers. It's hurting pork producers. And it's going to keep hurting more and more in so many other ways you can't imagine. At the end of the day, that's not the real problem. Because eventually the Chinese will win, for a whole bunch of reasons they'll win. The real problem is if the Chinese weren't as smart as they are, all they have to do to win the trade war in 1 minute is to call up the Secretary of the Treasury and say, we're not going to come to the auction tomorrow and buy long-term debt. Now, just last week, China moved $32 billion out of their current account reserves because they wanted to shore up the renminbi, or some people call it the yuan, but it's the renminbi. And they wanted the value of the renminbi to stay above a certain marker level, 0.7. First of all, it's interesting that it only took them $32 billion, which is a pretty small number when you talk about international currencies. It's very small.
So they
moved $32 billion out of the current account, and they basically put it into their financial system as a way to absorb renminbi, right? To suck up renminbi.
So shoring up their own currency.
They bought up their own currency. Yeah. For So 32 billion, small number. Okay. But the part I really want to focus on is at the high water mark this year, China was holding over $4 trillion, for the most part, American debt in reserves. They're still sitting at about $3.5 trillion. So when you look at 32 billion to shore up their currency, and they got 3.5 trillion
of U.S. debt.
Of U.S. debt. Hello, who's got the power here? Basically, China's our banker. In fact, the only reason they're not cratering us is because we owe them so much money, it would hurt them too. But if they really wanted to play hardball, all they have to do is to say, you know what, we're not coming to the auction today. And Steve Mnuchin would collapse like a whimpering two-year-old, because that would be the end of the international monetary system, as you know it. So
that's their nuclear option.
They have a nuclear, and we don't have one.
We don't have that against them, but they have that against us.
Now, the other thing they've got that we don't have is nobody votes there. So if sooner or later, you're going to find that the farmers in Iowa are going to get tired of not being able to sell their soybeans and their pigs and their cows and their chickens. And the same is going to happen to be the farmers in Arkansas and the farmers in Kansas. And what's going to happen is, and the farmers in Brazil are going to keep doing happy day, right? So what's going to happen is they're going to be able to keep pressure on us indefinitely, including the voting public of the Midwest that has been Trump's main base of support, indefinitely. And we got nothing to do about that. I did an analysis with some people just recently of what the impact to consumer purchasing in the U.S. will be if we go to this next stage, which everyone's predicting will happen by December 10th if there's no agreement in the G20 meeting. And it turns out it's a pretty good whack. If they throw another 25% tariff on the things that they have not tariffed yet, it's going to have a significant depressive effect on spending.
For American spending?
Yeah.
Because the all goods.
All tariffs are paid by the person consuming the goods. So the tariff we put on Chinese stuff costs us Americans more money. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. A tariff works against the people who exercise it. And the one who wins is the one who can last the longest. And we're not even remotely capable of lasting as long as China, because they don't vote and we do. So even if they're Iowa farmers, we're willing to stick with Stephen King this year, forget it in 2 years.
Right. So just to go back, we're talking about the possibility now to reorient on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we haven't quite gotten there yet, and it seems like what the Trump administration has been doing with the tariffs and the oil they're throwing onto the fire, even against our allies like Mexico and Canada and the EU, is kind of rearranging the world economy specifically in ways that does not actually favor the United States economy.
No, and it comes at a time when the global economy is already weak.
Right.
So the last thing you would want it to have done would be doing to further weaken the international trade.
Throwing oil on that
fire.
On that fire there.
Yeah.
And so McConnell, you said, is the most powerful man in Washington right now.
Yeah. And I think
how can they step in and actually change? I mean, is there something they can do against these?
Yeah. Well, no. When he's ready, and I think it'll be sometime between now and 2020. I don't think McConnell's going to want to go into the 2020 Senate elections with Trump as the president, because it's too big an anchor look what already happened.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll watch and see how this all, he'll watch and see how the people get tired and go back to the farm and forget that there was an uprising, or do they keep their pitchfork and candles and keep coming at the castle? I predict they're going to keep coming at the castle, in which case Trump is a bigger liability than an asset. Once that's clear, McConnell takes him out, and then he gets Pence. And I think he'd rather have Pence going into the 2020 election than Trump, because Pence is inoffensive to most people. Not to me, but to most people. Whereas Trump is patently offensive. And what Trump does is he brings out, for the third of his own people that he brought out to his base, he catalyzed more than that to come out against him, which is why he lost by over 6 million votes. And he made it about him. I mean, he came to this Trump. My name's on the ballot. It's not, but pretend like it is. So he made it about him, and the people spoke. And I think what's going to be important to watch are, what are the things that we can expect now in the economy as a result of those political changes?
Right,
first one will be infrastructure bill. Pelosi's already talking about it. McConnell's already winking at it.
Trump even talked about it.
Trump will be talking about it more now, because it's the one thing he can get going. That infrastructure bill is going to be so important for two reasons. One, we desperately need infrastructure. Well, three reasons. Number one, we desperately need infrastructure. Our bridges are decaying. Over half of them are dangerously so. Our roads are in terrible shape. We haven't upgraded our rail system since the 1800s, literally. I mean, we invented a long-distance rail, and we're one of the worst industrial countries in the world with it. So we have all these different issues.
Our airports are a mess. Our ports of entry.
Everything. You know. Mm-hmm. So what it does is it creates a lot of, well, good-paying jobs, which would be great for the economy, will increase spending. So that's going to be good. And it's jobs that can't be exported, right? By definition, the bridge is here. You got to build it here. The second reason why it's significant is not only will it generate tons of revenue, and they're going to have to figure out how to pay for that. Now, McConnell said, and he knows he can't do it now, well, we'll take it out of Social Security and Medicaid. Can't do that. It's like a third rail now. So where are they going to get the money? And that's the second reason this is interesting. They're going to have to come up, I believe, with either an income tax on the upper 2%. Sometimes it's done like an excise tax. Sometimes it can be done as a supplemental income tax. It can be done for a limited period of time. It can be done indefinitely. But he cannot tax the middle class, for sure. And he's going to have to pay for that infrastructure. How are they going to cut that deal? And Trump's got nothing to do with that because Trump won't even know what the deal is until someone tells him. Mm-hmm. So it's between McConnell and Pelosi to come figure that one out. And of the two, they're both wily old cats. I think that they will end up with a compromise, which Pelosi will end up liking, I think. And Mitch McConnell will like because it will keep him alive to fight another day. What else can we see that will affect the economy? You can expect that interest rates will continue to go up in December. Going to get another bump from the Fed, which means there will be continued downward pressure on new house construction. Mm-hmm. So we're going into our fourth month of below anticipated new home construction. Mm-hmm. Huge story. People don't realize because new home construction is like one of the fundamental engines of the economy. It's not just that you built a home. It's that you used the lumber. It's that you used the copper. You used the metal. You had the plumber. You had the electrician. It's a big deal. And when housing starts are off, it has a ripple effect. And we're now going to our fourth month, which means those ripples are starting to
hit the economy.
Yeah, throughout the economy. Next, you've got a complete realignment going on in the transportation industry. You got a situation where literally today, every train that can carry oil is already occupied. Every pipeline that can carry oil in America is occupied. I was just in a meeting in Houston with a bunch of oil people, and they were telling me the reason they're not fracking more right now is because there's no way to get it to market. It's like everything's bulging at the seams, and there's huge reserves all over the place. Mm-hmm. So just a quick throw off is I don't see oil going up. It's at 60 today. I think it could go sideways, could probably even dip down to the 50s, mm-hmm. And we'll look at it again. But the strategy of punishing Iran and trying to keep their oil off the market has failed miserably. It's helped Russia. In fact, I'm going to guess that Putin put him up to it, that whole Iranian thing, because Russia has made billions and billions. Last time I checked, $6.8 billion in the last period just on the extra money it got from its oil.
It's the Trump's Russia enrichment program.
Yes. And it's working because what the Russians have said, they're going to buy a whole bunch of oil from Iran every day, hundreds of millions of barrels, and they're going to take it in trade for food and medicines, which would mean technically they're not even violating the sanctions. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to take that same amount of oil, which they would have burned, but now they're going to burn Iranian oil, and they'll sell their oil overseas for $60 or more per barrel. Plus, because of the fear that Iran will be cut off, Russia's already increased its pumping capacity dramatically in the last 12 months and will be increasing it some more in the next 6 to 7 months. So Russia's making money hand over fist, A, because we put this kibosh on Iran, and B, because Russia recognizes that turmoil in the world drives oil prices up, and Russia has got only one thing to sell to the world, and that's oil. And Iran's not going to get cut off, that's clear. I think they've written 7 or 8 waivers now. China's allowed to buy from Iran. India's allowed to buy from Iran. I mean, it's all silly. Yeah. It's just like it was a phony thing to say that NAFTA's gone. It's the same thing, just recolored. It's a phony thing to say that the Iranian oil's not coming to market. If it were not coming to market, you'd see oil prices up in the 80s mm-hmm. or higher. Okay, so that's
so
that.
So I just want to remind you about Ford buying the scooter company, yeah, which so Ford is another signal that there's a change in the transportation.
Yeah, so Ford buys an electric scooter company. Why? Well, combined with the fact that the housing starts are down, it's clear that millennials would rather have an electric scooter or walk or bicycle to work than drive a Ford or a GM or a Chrysler. So what's happening is the population of the country is resorting itself into urban environments. And what Ford's looking at is saying, okay,
What's our business if the idea for 100 years of have a family automobile or two no longer is the driving central idea?
That's not the model for the future.
No longer the model. So I'm hoping that people like Ford and General Motors will recognize that they're not in the car business. They're in the people and goods transportation business.
Right.
And that means they should start looking at inner city. They should be looking at electric scooters. They should be looking at electric trains. They ought to be looking at hydrogen trains like Germany is, because Germany has bought a whole bunch of hydrogen trains. So I think that the opportunity now is there, as not only building our infrastructure, which will be great for the economy, I believe the opportunity is there for us to restructure our industries.
Yeah.
So they become industries of the future. Let's make stuff for the next 100 years, not for the last
100. Well, even when thinking about how are we going to rebuild our infrastructure, let's not do it with the interstate transportation model. Let's do it with the electric car, with trains. Let's look at it from a different perspective. Let's look at it from the future.
And let's embrace it, because it's in our interests.
And that will create tremendous economic opportunities.
Now, let me go to the next one. Because of the political change, despite his best efforts in corrupting the EPA, Trump did not succeed in stopping the move to renewable energy. Slowed it a bit. Didn't stop it.
It's paying for itself. You can't stop it. That's the direction.
It's too late.
It's too late.
Yeah. Now, if you combine that with climate change, I'll come back to that climate change issue in a moment. But if you combine these two, you go, oh, so the biggest economic opportunity facing the United States is the ability to create the first country beyond fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. Now, Iceland has declared they're going to do that. One other country is well on its way. Spain is doing surprisingly well.
Spain, Portugal?
Portugal is doing very well in that regard. Anyway, my point of saying this is, we have the technological base, we have the financial base. The amount of money and energy and time it will take is in the quadrillions. It's not even in the trillions. And so it's the one thing that's big enough that can really occupy our economy and massively create wealth. And I want to point out, as I have in the past in the show, whenever human society has switched from one form of energy to another globally, it unlocks massive amounts of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you're going from wood to coal, or you're going from wind to wood, or you're going from coal to whale blubber, and then from whale blubber to gas, and gas to oil, every time you make one of those changes, you get this mushrooming effect in the economy. And the one thing big enough to really keep us busy as a global economy, generating a 3-6% cumulative compounded growth rate, which is totally doable, is replacing the fossil fuel system.
Mm-hmm.
And climate change tells us we've got to, whether we like it or not.
Speaking of burning wood. We've got fires in California.
Again,
that just started yesterday.
So I was flying home from Houston last night, and I was about 10:30 at night, and I was flying over Camarillo and Thousand Oaks. And I see these two enormous, I didn't know there were two fires down there, enormous fires. One of them was completely blocked in 101, as you know, which is the main artery between LA and Santa Barbara. But the other one is even bigger, and it's like it's going on crazy at Thousand Oaks. And this follows by less than a week, or about 3 days, I guess, since Paradise.
No, I think that happened in the same time frame.
It's like a day ago.
Paradise is lost.
Paradise is lost. Paradise is gone. Paradise, California doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Now, that happens in a year when we haven't forgotten that the second largest fire in the history of California was last December, and the largest one in the history of California was just in February.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's November. It's supposed to be winter already, folks. We're not supposed to be having fires. And we have these massive fires.
And it's
cold.
So
what's that about?
It's not even that hot.
So what it's about is the pressure cooker, which is climate change, is going to continue to exert enormous negative drag on the society and on the economy unless we turn it to a plus. So if you try to just, for example, the classic example is Puerto Rico. If what you do is you replace, which is what they're doing, the infrastructure in Puerto Rico, which has taken them 14 months, it's just barely getting completed, it'll get blown out in the next hurricane. Are they going to do it again? I don't think so. They didn't have the money to do it this time. On the other hand, if you were to build a microgridded distributed system without long-distance transmission lines, they could have all the hurricanes they want. It wouldn't take the electrical system down for more than a day or two, if that. So it's like, we got to get smart. And we will or we won't. If we do, we'll make a lot of money. Because getting smart makes money. And if we stay stupid, we're going to lose a lot of money. And to me, climate change is this huge pressure cooker. And then when you throw into this pressure cooker the fact that Kim Jong-un thinks the president is an idiot, and he's right, and that he, you know, I was quoting to you earlier,
North Koreans have the capacity to manufacture 6 to 7 nuclear bombs, meaning they have enough material, fissile material, per year. So Kim Jong-un has been doing this dance with Trump to the point where I love Kim. Oh, we're in love. It's like
writing love letters to each other.
He went from rocket man to we're in love. It's amazing. But in that 1 year where Kim Jong did rope-a-dope, right? He did the rope-a-dope, and he built 7 more bombs.
So now he has 14 bombs.
14 ahead and climbing. And this Thursday, yesterday, they were supposed to go out and have a meeting with the head of the security apparatus of North Korea on behalf of Kim Jong-un and Mike Pompeo. The meeting was canceled according to a written statement released by the State Department yesterday with no explanation. The meeting has been postponed to a later date. Period, full stop. Meaning, they're not even telling us who canceled or why. I got to tell you, Kim Jong-un's got to be laughing up his sleeve. I mean, he's got to be just laughing up uproariously. But what he doesn't understand is he's in the pressure cooker too. The few people who really get the pressure cooker that understand it are Xi out of China. Putin understands it. That's about it. Those are the two main players on the scene that understand it. Everybody else is like a blind man in a room with no light, bumping into chairs. Back to Peter Navarro, our salvation is if the business community will actually say, hey, this is what you got to do now because you made a mess here and we got to fix this mess. And I know that business, in order to protect its own economics, will step increasingly into the breach. I just hope that they don't keep it so narrow that they're only looking at their narrow self-interest, which also benefits us because it's the economy, but the broader interest in society. Because if they want to have a domestic market that will consume greater and greater amounts of stuff, which makes more and more money for them, they've got to be willing to allow consumers to not have to run up massive debt.
Right.
They've got to put more money in consumer pockets. I was mentioning to you, Christy, a little while ago about sometimes the economists in this world absolutely drive me to drink. Fortunately, I don't drink during the day. But I got to tell you, in the same article where we report consumer debt in September was up $10.9 billion, indicating that consumers spent that much more money than they had. Now, in the abstract, some people say, well, that's great. They spent $10 billion. They borrowed $10 billion more. No, but they had done $22 billion the month before. And that's what gave rise to people's belief that we were going to have a 3 or 4% GDP. We're not. That's mm-hmm. crazy talk. So what they did is they cut it in more than half. They did 45% of the consumption that they did in the month of August and September. That's a big change.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, all the common consensus amongst economists was they were going to do at least 16 and a half, 17 billion. And they only did 10. And so the lead here is, oops, we're off the number that we thought was going to produce the future benefits. And in the same article that reports that story, it quotes, you can't make this stuff up. Quote, analysts believe consumer spending will continue to provide a strong underpinning to growth, close quote. It just went down. It didn't go up. So how is that a strong underpinning? So to me, that's a fantasy.
And it's still borrowing against the future.
Yeah, you're going to see inflation go up. Housing starts are going to continue going down. Oil's going to go sideways or slightly down. It might get to the 50s. You're going to see, by the way, central banks are starting to buy gold at a pretty hefty rate right now. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who are worried that you bought gold when I told you to a year ago, for every $1,200 you invested, you lost 60. So maybe one night out at a cheap restaurant. But every night you went to sleep knowing you had gold and everybody else didn't. You're going to be very glad because that 60 bucks is coming back to you and then some. And you aren't going to have to worry with what's coming next, which is that we had a decline of 9% last month. So the Dow, which again, the Dow is the market, it's not the economy. But the Dow went down 9%, which is a good size dip, recovered most of that 9%, is now going sideways. But it's going sideways and a slope that's inextricably down. So I asked both of you before the show, there's this uncool statement. You got to be careful what metaphors you use these days. Like, you know, I mentioned it's called the dead cat bounce.
What's the dead cat bounce?
So I don't want to say that because it sounds like, you know, like PETA would be very upset with me. But this is not referring to a real animal.
And this is, you're talking about the stock market. Okay. So
yeah.
It's in a dead cat bounce, right?
It did
now.
A dead cat bounce.
What's a dead cat?
So you had asked me, you said, how do you explain the market went up 590 points after the election, when the day after the election? And I said, well, it's a dead cat bounce. And I said, did you ever hear that expression? She goes, no. And I said, well, maybe it's not cool to say that because, you know, you can't say kill two birds with one stone anymore. That's not cool for sure. But what dead cat bounce means, and if you go Google it, it's a term you'll see instantly. It's a financial term. And what it means is, God forbid, you drop a cat off the roof and he hits the ground it will kill the cat, but the cat will bounce. And then what you want to do is make a lot of money while he's up in the air, because he is coming down again and you know it. So it's a way to suck people into the investment markets when you know something bad is coming. That's what a dead cat bounce is. So it's when you pull people in knowing that things are about to get not so good, and you might as well get fresh money on the table, because when they find out what you know, they're going to be selling. And that's exactly what happened the next day, right? Down 270 points. So what you're seeing now is a prolonged downward. Sideways will look like a good day. Downward will look more common. We'll give up all of that 9% for sure, and probably at least another 9 or 10% more. So I'm still looking for a 15 to 20% correction. Mm-hmm. And I can see for a lot of reasons why that's likely to happen. As it happens, equities then will start to be more attractive. They are not attractive now. And I read something by an analyst, I won't even quote it, it was so silly, that equities were reasonably priced, quote unquote. Well, that's crazy. There's nothing reasonable about the pricing of the equities right now. The equities are at multiples that are completely non-sustainable. So that's an issue. People thought, well, because the bonds now are paying more interest, got to be careful, because when you can make more money in a bond or a COD, certificate of deposits. Mm-hmm. I just saw an advertisement for a COD, for a one-year COD offering 2.8%. That's pretty good. So that says somebody's figuring it's going to go higher. Mm-hmm. And they're right. It will. And you're going to see 30-year interest rates. I was just on a phone call this morning with Terry, as you know, and we were talking about the shopping center deal. We're talking about, you know, when to refinance. And we both agreed that if we can't get it done this quickly, if we could refinance today, we'd far prefer that to a year from today.
Yeah.
Meaning the interest rates would be that much better.
They'll continue to go up.
But we have other business reasons why we can't do it instantly. But so now we're planning how to do it as soon as possible. I think you're going to see deferred consumption is going to start setting in a few months. People, when they get past Christmas, Christmas is a funny date, because people give themselves permission at Christmas to do silly things, buy stuff they shouldn't, throw money around. You know, I'll reform myself on January 1st when I do my January.
My New Year's resolutions.
My New Year's resolutions.
No more debt.
No more debt for the next 34 minutes. Anyway, but people give themselves permission at Christmas time, because we encourage them to spend beyond their means, which they will do. Now, whether they'll go as deep in as $22 billion in 1 month, I don't know. I think that's too deep right now. But they'll do something to jack it up. So we'll get through Christmas. It ain't going to be a great Christmas. It's not going to be a barn burner. It's going to be an okay Christmas. When that's behind us, when that last bit of sugar works its way out of our system, Katie, bar the door. Fundamentals are bad. Yeah.
We were already talking about how we are still rolling into recession, and that's
And that's not changing.
And that's not changing.
No, and in fact, that's what the 9-point drop before the election was about. Mm-hmm. It's the recognition by the investment community that we're rolling into a recession for reasons that Wall Street has spun very well. It was able to continue to push the idea that equities could go higher, when in fact they can't.
So we're coming down to the end of the hour.
Gosh, that went fast.
It did. So I just wondered if there's anything that we really wanted to touch on.
Let's really quickly. So we talked a lot, one or two shows ago about the inverted yield curve. Remember that? And that's when the long-term rates drop below the short-term rates. So that's no longer a threat. Unfortunately, it's no longer a threat for the wrong reason. The wrong reason is that the long-term yields have gone up considerably. So now the spread is growing between short-term and long-term, which is appropriate, because short-term debt should carry less interest. But it also says that you're going to have that continued downward pressure on 30-year mortgages. You're going to have continued downward pressure on 5-year car payments and 5-year car purchases. You're going to see leasing costs a little higher. So we're going to be absorbing more money in the economy for finance charges. And it won't come back to older people in the form of higher interest rates in their bank deposits as quickly as it goes out in the form of either inflation or higher prices.
Mm-hmm. That's a concern.
Yeah, I also want to talk about jobs. I think that I don't even know if I believe this number, but if in fact that we grew 250,000 jobs in the month of October, and I don't think we did, but if we did, that's phenomenal, because we were averaging about 150,000. 250 is more like an Obama number. 150 would be more like what we've been doing the last year. So I'm really going to expect there's going to be a downward revision of that number when it gets resent out. And I think what's important about it is that's a magic number. At our size in terms of population, we have to have 250,000 people, new jobs, just to stand still. That doesn't eat up and drop the unemployment rate. That keeps it where it's at. And there's something going on with the unemployment numbers anyway that I don't fully trust. But whatever's going on, at 250,000, that's a safe number. I don't believe it will continue. If it does, hallelujah.
My guess is it's going to go back down to the 150,000 to 175,000 level. And my guess is that when that number is reissued, because as you know, after we issue it, then a month or so later, when no one's paying attention, we reissue it. It usually comes out higher. So I think that number is going to come out worse when it gets reissued. But for right now, we got a comment. It's a very good jobs growth number, even though I'm very skeptical of what people are quoting as the unemployment rate at 3.7%. So those are some things that are important. We've already covered most of the important ones in terms of oil, gas, all that sort of thing. I do believe that there's a fund right now, by the way. I'm getting more information about it, and I will tell our listeners next month about it. A guy named David Vogel put it together. And what he's doing, which I think is really smart, is he's shorting oil company stocks. And he's doing it for all the right reasons. He's basically saying, and then I'll end on this note, and this is something that Matt Taibbi first started writing about in Rolling Stone a number of years ago, and many people have now focused on, and that is, the way you value an oil company is you value it by what are called proven reserves. That's oil in the ground that they can extract for a profit. That's what a proven reserve is. And what Taibbi correctly said, and there's no question now he's right, if you look at all that oil in the ground that's showing as reserves, half of it will never get pumped and sold. Meaning that half the oil on the oil company balance sheets is water.
Right.
Which means they're worth half of what you think they are. So someone like David Vogel, who put together a fund to short oil stocks, is probably going to make a lot of money for people.
Yeah. Well, isn't Exxon being sued right now for misrepresenting their balance sheet exactly in this way?
Yeah, and in a state court, which is good because it'll get nailed there. Yeah, no, there's no question they misrepresented their balance sheet, and they will continue to do so. But they're all misrepresenting it. Absolutely. Shell is, BP is, they all are. Because they know that they're never going to pump all that.
Right.
In fact, if they did, there wouldn't be a planet to sell it on because we'd be so far past toasty.
Right.
You know, it would be nobody to buy it. And as it is, and I'm just going to end on this, like back on this comment about climate change. Climate change is this giant pressure cooker. People don't understand. It's a huge pressure cooker. And so what happened a week and a half, 2 weeks ago when the IPCC said that by 2045, millions of people will be dying from climate change. That's so optimistic. People are already dying from climate change. And in the millions, by the way. By 2030, it's going to be in the tens of millions of people dying. Way before 2045. 2030 is right around the corner. We're talking 10 years away. So I'm very, very concerned because the fires won't stop in California because there's no more lumber to burn. I'm concerned that the crisis of water that you saw last month all across the country. And look, I mean, I was in Venice 3 or 4 weeks ago now. And when I left, there's these portable sidewalks they use in Venice. And when you walk around town just before a high tide comes in, they have them stacked up. And they're like, they look like walkways. They have slats, but they're a couple of feet up off the ground. And so they stack them up. And then when the high water comes, they put them down. That's how you cross in Venice. That's how you get from one side of the piazza to the other. And as we're leaving, I'm noticing the water's already coming up over the curb. And I go, boy, I'm glad we're leaving town because they got these out here for a reason. There's something coming on. And sure enough, last week, Venice water peaked 5 feet higher than normal. Mm-hmm. It was so high, they didn't bother putting those artificial walkways up because
it wouldn't have done anything anyway.
And by the time the photographers could get out of their hotel rooms, it was still 2.5 feet above normal. I mean, like people were, their water was up to their waist. Now, why is that important? Because Venice is so far away. Because Venice is just that canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. There is actually an island that was discovered in Japan. Do you know about this? And it sank and we didn't notice. It's gone. And nobody noticed for a couple of years. You know, the Marshall Islands are clearly going to get inundated.
Right.
I mean, Bangladesh right now, about 30% of Bangladesh goes underwater every year. And the number's growing. And those people keep getting pushed further and further north. Well, further and further, that's Pakistan. And they don't take the foreigners real well. So there's going to be a massive amount of conflict there. You've got this whole situation in Africa, where it's the desertification of Africa. We had 64 million refugees last year aiming at Europe, and of those, the vast majority were Africans. Now, here's an example of how you can make lemonade out of lemons. If you know that climate change is the pressure cooker, and you know that changing off of fossil fuel is the big economic opportunity, and you know you got all these people in Africa who really don't want to leave their homes, but are going to die if they stay there because there's no water and there's no industry, here's what the win is. You create a solar industry, as an example, in Africa, where there's lots of sunshine, and you create water capture systems, which we can talk about, and you take that solar energy and you sell it. And there's many different ways you can sell it, including you can sell it as hydrogen. Mm-hmm. And what you could do is to create entire industries in Africa that would be able to combat climate change. So let me give you another example. What else could you do with a lot of energy? So now picture the sun, picture Africa, picture solar. You could scrub the CO2. So what if the CO2 scrubbing capital of the world became Nigeria? Think about that. What if the Sahara Desert became the place where we sucked the CO2 out of the air? Now, I believe, as I've said on the show in the past, I think we can do it today for about $100 a ton. That's a fraction of what it's going to cost if we let this thing inundate all our major cities like Venice. And Washington, you're going to get it next. And Baltimore. And New York. And New York, Beijing.
Miami will be gone.
London. Miami. Well, Miami's gone now. I mean, Miami on a clear day is gone. I mean, that's the whole other story. But my point is, think of that. Wouldn't that be a wonderful way to get that? Like, you take a terrible situation, the desertification of Africa, and you flip it and go, oh, that could become the cleanup of the planet. And you know how much money they could make doing that? If they were selling carbon at $100 a ton, I got to tell you, there'd be no poor Africans in that village. Those guys would be doing real well. And they could afford to pay to import water at that point. Mm-hmm. They could afford to drill deeper wells. They could afford to, have you ever heard about water capture from...
Yeah, there was an article. There was an article today in the Optimist Daily, actually, about water capture from the air.
From the air, using solar.
It
absolutely works, and we now have some synthetic fibers that are so efficient that the temperature differential between hot desert day and cool desert night is enough to trap unbelievable number of liters of water. So take that. You know, you got Bill Gates, who has just introduced his new toilet. I don't know if you've heard about that.
I read about that in the Optimist Daily also.
You know, all the good stuff is in the Optimist Daily.
Yeah,
okay, so let's end on that
note.
Let's
end with a plug for the Optimist Daily, why don't we?
So what's the number one thing you want to have to get through this? You got to be an optimist. If you don't look at the problem and focus your energy on what the solution could and should be, you'll be so depressed, you'll become catatonic. On the other hand, if you like the Optimist Daily, which I want everybody to take the service, it's free, folks, so sign up. info@worldbusiness.org. Get a free subscription. You can have it come once a week, five times a week, whatever you like. And start your day for 2 minutes finding about optimistic solutions. I didn't know about those stories that were in there, but that's a good example. So you can capture water. You could turn the worst nightmare countries in the world, the ones that are literally baking to death in the Sahara, and turn them into the cleaner, clean capitals of the world. Because remember, CO2 anywhere is ambient. So anywhere I capture it, if I capture that CO2 in Africa, I'm taking it out of North America. And I think that should be the cleaning capital of the world. The vacuum cleaner for CO2 ought to be the Sahara Desert. And any other desert, because you got solar and you got CO2.
Absolutely. Yeah. So
that would be a great solution.
I like it. All right. Well, that is our show for today.
Great. I think we're going to have are we doing a show next month? I hope. Are we?
We'll do something in December for sure. And
yeah, we should, because we might have a surprise announcement in December.
Okay. So let's hold off on that.
Folks, if you send in questions, we'll answer them. If you don't, we'll guess the best we can what you want to hear about.
We got a couple of comments from our show last month, and that's great. And we'll bring those up in our next show for sure.
Right. So subscribe to Optimist Daily.
Yes. So, and reach out to us at info@worldbusiness.org if you have any questions. And thanks so much.
Thank you, everyone.